Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. So glad you're with me this morning. It is Thursday, and it is December 21st. And you know what that is? Summer solstice is June 20th, which means today is winter solstice. So we're on our way to summer solstice, which is, for me, a happy thought because I'm not a fan of winter. I got to be honest. I don't like the cold. I'm not an outdoorsy kind of put on the snowshoes and go. I just don't like that. I pretty much like the... I'm an avid indoorsman. There, I said it, okay? I saw in the paper today, a salad a day keeps the brain 11 years younger. Fortunately, you will need those additional 11 years of brain power to search for meat. That's just my thought. All right. Very cool. They got this tax bill passed. So companies are announcing bonuses and pay raises after Congress passed the Republican tax reform bill. AT&T, for example, said that it will pay bonuses of $1,000 to each of its more than 200,000 U.S. employees. Comcast is doing the same, and while Wells Fargo and Fifth Third Bank said they will raise their minimum wage to $15 an hour after President Trump signs the bill into law. So it sounds like workers are getting some of their own money back, or companies are, when they're getting the tax rate lowered from 35 to 21%, that means that the companies are handing out some cash. That I like. That's good news. All right. We've got a great show. Michael Heisner, what an interesting guy. Oh, my. He's written a book. He is way above my pay grade. Very smart. We're going to start with that. It's 6 minutes after the hour. Thanks for being with us. Welcome back to the show. I am so glad you're with us this morning. My next guest, Dr. Michael Heisner, when I heard his name and I found out that he got his PhD in Madison, Wisconsin, and his topic was on recovering the supernatural, I thought it was going to be an update on how Aaron Rodgers is doing. But there again, I don't pay attention very much at my job, and I have to pay better attention at my job. Dr. Michael Heisner is an author. He's written many books. The one we're going to talk about today is called The Unseen Realm, Recovering the Supernatural Worldview of the Bible. And I have to say, this book is amazing. Mike, good morning.
Good morning.
This has been about a 15-year project for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. It's taken a long time. It was a putter project, actually, while I was working on my dissertation and then thereafter. So it's taken a while, but we got it done.
Okay, now we have a tendency sometimes of avoiding thorny biblical passages, and I don't know why we do that, but we have a tendency of doing that, don't we?
Yeah, we do, and that's one of the objections in the book. You know, I unfortunately speak here to myself at one point in life, and to lots of Christians, but we've sort of been trained to think that these weird passages in the Bible just don't deserve attention. They don't really mean anything. They're just sort of scattershot, strange stuff, and they're too peripheral to matter. But that is not the case.
Well, I want to jump into some of these passages. I want to have you talk about them. Now, the psalmist declared that God presides over an assembly of divine beings. That's in Psalm 82, verse 1. And it talks about in Job, when God's having a conversation with Job, in verse 7 it says, when the morning stars were singing together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. So the sons of God, they were there all along, weren't they, from the beginning?
Yeah, they precede the creation of the world and humanity. We know from various passages in the Old Testament and then some sort of catch-all passages in the New Testament that, you know, all things in heaven and earth, visible and invisible, were created by, you know, the God of the Bible, the God of Israel, Yahweh. So they're created beings. They just precede everything else that we sort of think of when we are reading Genesis, that sort of stuff.
And I'm looking at things like the Garden of Eden, and you know, for some reason, I always kind of had in my mind, and this is again something you've helped me understand better, that the garden itself was a plot of specific beauty that existed on Earth. It wasn't the entire Earth made up of this garden, right?
Right. If we read Genesis 2, lo and behold, Eden has geography. You know, it's not the whole world, you know, but that's a good example of sort of the things that Christians know that aren't really true when it comes to biblical content. And the unseen realm, if I could be so bold to say, makes a habit of ferreting out things that we think we know that really are not the case. And then drawing attention to, you know, things that we just sort of deliberately gloss over or were taught by our tradition to ignore and gloss over. So I like to put it this way, you know, the book is not just about, you know, to use imprecise terms, angels and demons. Again, there's a lot more going on in the supernatural world than angels and demons and, you know, Satan and God and things like that. I mean, there's lots of vocabulary, lots of hierarchy, lots of nuance, and those things work themselves out in the passages, again, that we think are kind of strange. But the goal of the book is to present the overarching, from Genesis to Revelation, supernatural epic that we call the biblical story, because that's what it is. The Bible is full of interactions between the unseen world and our world, and its writers and its original audience. We're predisposed to think about the world and about life as really intersecting with the supernatural. We are not. We are, unfortunately, Christians today, many of them, are just products of the Enlightenment. You know, we talk about being believers in the supernatural, but we think and we live like skeptics because we're just a product of modernity. But the biblical writers were not. They come from a different time and a different place. You know, if you had an Israelite or a first century Jew in your home Bible study, you know, we've all been to these things, you know, that you sit around in a circle and, hey, what does this passage mean to you? How did it speak to you? You know, what do we think's going on here? If you had an ancient Israelite in there, when you got to that guy, his answer would basically freak you out.
Yeah.
Because he's just coming from a totally different perspective, a different time and a different place. And what Unseen Realm tries to do is convince people that you ought to have the Israelite living in your head. You ought to have the first century Jew living in your head, because we mistakenly think that the right context for interpreting the Bible is our context, or the Reformation, or the Church Fathers, or evangelicalism, or whatever. And all those are post-biblical contexts. The right context for interpreting Scripture is the context that produced the thing, you know, this thing we call the Bible, the context in which God prompted people to write, which is an entirely different worldview, one that is just drenched in, you know, the predisposition to believe in the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite different than ours.
Michael, this is so fascinating, and I love what you're encouraging us as believers to do. And I want to ask a couple of questions, and then after the break, I'm going to bring out the heavy artillery. But here's a question before we go to break. Something like this. Why wasn't Eve surprised when the serpent spoke to her?
Yeah, this is actually a simple but complicated question and answer. Because you have to understand how an ancient person would have perceived Eden and the way Eden is described. Eden is God's home. Think of it as a temple. Okay, think of it as the place of, you know, where God dwells and where God is, his entourage, his administration, his bureaucracy, his host, his council. That's where they are too. And the Bible has lots of different vocabulary for the members of the divine council, the heavenly host. And some of those are terms that would be describing throne guardians, cherubim, seraphim. Those terms come from different ancient Near Eastern languages. Cherubim comes from a Babylonian word, and seraphim comes from an Egyptian term. And it just so happens that one of those, the seraphim, is portrayed as serpentine. Okay, so if we take that backdrop, you know, the guardianship of the divine entourage, and we think about what's going on in Eden, and we add to the picture Ezekiel 28, where the rebel is described as an anointed cherub, you know, that one of these throne guardians, they're going to have creaturely appearance. And so my view of this is that when you get to Genesis 3, the rebel there is called Nakash, which, yes, that can be translated serpent, but it can also be translated shining one, or the one who dispenses divine knowledge. Nakash, again, I think all of this is deliberate. Ancient people weren't dumb. They know snakes don't talk. And so when they see a talking, you know, serpent or something that looks serpentine but might also be luminous, you know, which is typically the way the Bible describes divine beings, that this is what we have. We don't have a member of the animal kingdom. We have a divine being that, again, could be, you know, some sort of serpentine appearance, could be luminous. You know, we don't know for sure, because it can actually be translated a number of ways. But here's the important point. Eve lives in Eden, too. She lives in God's house, too. She's seen his entourage before. This is not her first encounter with a divine being. And so whatever it looked like, however it presented itself to her, this is not her first go-round. She's not surprised, and she just has a conversation with this particular being who is going to deceive her, as we know. But it's not a shocking experience to her. It's shocking to us because of just the oddity of it. But an ancient person would have known, hey, snakes don't talk. So she's talking to a member of the divine entourage, the divine council, and there's something going on here that, you know, is sort of more than meets the eye. There's something beyond how this entity is being described. So it draws their interest, you know, into the story.
Yeah. Michael, I am sitting at your footsteps listening so intently. I'm going to take a break. When I come back, more with Dr. Michael Heiser in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have on our studio line Dr. Michael Heiser. He is a scholar and in biblical studies, and he is a scholar in residence at Faith Life, the makers of Logos Bible Software, which I have. He's authored many books. One that we are talking about today is called The Unseen Realm, Recovering the Supernatural Worldview of the Bible. And Michael, I'm curious about Paul describing evil spirits in terms of having authority, governance, ruling. What's all that about?
Yeah, Paul inherits, you know, that let's just start this way. You know, Ephesians 6, everybody sort of is familiar with this passage, who's interested in the powers of darkness and whatnot, the principalities and powers. Again, that's sort of a familiar passage. But what's sort of escapes attention is that Paul has inherited a particular worldview from the Old Testament. And back in the Old Testament, at the Tower of Babel, there's something going on there that's more than just, hey, they're building a tower and God doesn't like it, which is typically what we think of. If we don't stay in Genesis 11, but if we go to a passage like Deuteronomy 32, 8 and 9, where it says, when the Most High, we know who that is, when the Most High divided up the nations, he divided them up according to the number of the sons of God. Now, we know when the division of the nations happened, that's Babel. But what's this sons of God stuff? Well, as I talk about at length in the book, what's going on here is that God has decided to punish humanity. Humanity has been relating to God as a collective up until this point in the biblical story. And God, after the flood, told them to disperse. But for some reason, they don't. They decide to, you know, congregate in Babylon and build this tower. And you know, all scholars, you know, of Old Testament would say, well, this tower is a ziggurat. That's what we build in Babylon, and I agree with that. But a ziggurat was part of a temple complex. So what they're actually doing is they're building this sort of pseudo-cosmic mountain, this replacement for the divine dwelling, to draw the deity to them instead of dispersing. An ancient Near Eastern person would have understood this immediately because they knew what temples were, they knew what ziggurats were, they knew why you built one.
Mm-hmm.
And God is offended at this and says, look, if you're not going to obey me, here we are after the flood, and you still, I'm still getting resistance here. If you're not going to obey me, fine, I'm going to disinherit you. I'm going to divorce you. I'm going to divide humanity up into a bunch of nations, and I'm going to assign them to lesser divine beings from my heavenly host. And I'm going to let them rule over you for a while. And now in verse 9, Deuteronomy 32:9, Israel is going to be my portion. Jacob is going to be my allotted inheritance. You say, well, who's that? Israel doesn't exist yet. That's why right after Babel, God calls Abraham and starts Israel, starts his own people. He starts over. But he's left the world in this fragmented state as a punishment. And the nations are assigned to other gods and other gods to the nations. There are other passages in Deuteronomy that deal with this, Deuteronomy 4:19 and 20, Deuteronomy 17:3, Deuteronomy 29, 24 through 26. Deuteronomy 32:17 says that the other nations are eventually, you know, victimized by these other gods. These other gods are called Shadim, which most English translations have as demons, which is an unfortunate translation. It's a territorial entity. Comes from Shadu in Akkadian. And so eventually this arrangement, these gods that God has assigned to the nations, it goes sour. They become seducers of God's own people. They become corrupt. This is what Psalm 82 is about, when God is railing against the other gods that are supposed to be doing a particular job that he tasked them with. It just degenerates into chaos. And Paul inherits this worldview. This is why when Paul describes the powers of darkness, okay, occasionally he uses the word demon, but most of the time, look, think about the vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
He uses principality, power, ruler, authority, throne, dominion. What do all these terms have in common? They are terms of geographical rulership. That's not a coincidence. Paul has inherited the worldview of Deuteronomy. He's inherited the worldview of Daniel 10. This is where the whole idea of supernatural princes ruling over nations comes from. It comes from Babel. It comes from Deuteronomy 32:8, but we never hit that passage when we learn about Babel in church or Sunday school. This mm-hmm. is where Paul's theology comes from. Scholars refer to this as cosmic geography, the notion in the Old Testament that deities are sort of attached or tied to geography. Israel is Yahweh's dominion. And so for the Israelite, that Israel is sacred space. Everything outside of that is icky. That's under the dominion of a hostile God. And it's dangerous. You know, we need to be protected from that. We need to not be there to be in right relationship with Yahweh. We need to be in the land. And again, this is a really, really quick, you know, overview of lots of meta concepts in the Old Testament, in the Bible, because the Old and New Testament connect these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the local church becomes sacred space and cosmic geography in the New Testament. Why? Because the presence of God lives in believers. You know, the same presence that was in the tabernacle, in the temple, in Israel, you know, that subsumed the land. We have all these connective ideas, and that's what I'm trying to do in Unseen Realm. I'm trying to get readers to have the ancient worldview, the ancient Israelite, in their head. Because if you do that, and this happened to me, this is not an overclaim because I want people to buy my book. This happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
If you start to read the Bible this way, like an ancient person, you will read your Bible again for the first time. It will just open up to you. If you can divorce yourself from your, you know, post-Enlightenment rationalism, where the supernatural is not uncomfortable anymore, but you read it like the biblical writers intended it to be read, like mm-hmm. God intended it to be read, it will open up to you in fascinating ways, and you'll be able to see the strangeness sort of make sense on its own terms.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a not only a perfect Christmas present, but a great New Year's resolution to start to try to think that way. Mike, I've just got about less than a minute, and I just have a quick question. Is there a supernatural meaning when Jehovah says, you shall have no other gods before me? Is that literal?
Yeah, I think he actually means what he says. You know, these places where Yahweh is the God of gods.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we've trained ourselves to think, oh, there are, you know, the gods weren't real. So in other words, God is claiming to be greater than things that don't exist. Well, look, I'm greater than things that don't exist. You know, where is the glory in that?
Mm-hmm.
It just eviscerates the passage of glory, you know, to God. You know, the gods are just spirit beings. Okay, we don't have more than one Yahweh. Yahweh is unique. In the book, I like to say he's species unique.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh is among the Elohim, but no other Elohim is Yahweh, because he is described in unique ways that no other Elohim ever gets described. He's
mm-hmm.
the lone sovereign. He's the creator. He's omnipotent. He's omniscient. You know, but we have to start dealing with the vocabulary, like plural Elohim in various Bible passages. We have to think about this. This is your profound statement of the day. We have to start taking the vocabulary of the Bible seriously and not explaining it away, not ignoring it.
Right.
And that's a challenge, you know, to lots of people, because believe it or not, our tradition has filtered the Bible to us in modern terms, and we need to get away from that.
Mm-hmm. Michael, the book is absolutely fascinating. It's rich and deep and a little complicated, but I'm a solid C student, and I'm getting through all of it and loving it. So thank you so much for writing it, and would love to have you on the program again.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Have a great day. That's Dr. Michael Heiser and his book, The Unseen Realm. You might want to jump over to Amazon.com and take a look at that and get that on your list of items to buy for your friends and relatives this Christmas. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Good morning and Merry Christmas. It is Thursday, December 21st. We're going to take a little break for news, and then we're going to chat with Kim Cattola. She's up next. Be back in a minute.
All year, the headlines have continued to bring the sobering news, reminders that our world is broken, and finding new ways to make the same mistakes it always has. Yet during December, the headlines fade for a moment, and the pages of history come to life with the story of a baby born humbly in Bethlehem. A baby whose life means there will be peace on earth and goodwill to men. A blessed and joyful Christmas from your friends at Faith Radio.
No one, no nation, no culture can survive. Left to itself, civilization self-destructs. This is Jim Garlow, and that's the bad news. But the good news is, God does love the world and preserves it from experiencing its own complete self-destruction. He does it through the gift of His Son, Jesus. And before Jesus left planet Earth, He launched one of God's best ideas, the church. And through the true church, God preserves us from inevitable self-destruction. Beginning some 2,000 years ago, the church has preserved and passed on the gospel, praying that people will open their hearts to receive it. When civilization as we know it does end, God's people will all be gathered ready to receive Him. It's something to celebrate at this Christmas season. God so loved the world that He gave His only Son, that whosoever believes in Him might have eternal life.
Good morning. It's 23 minutes till the top of the hour. So glad you're with me this morning. I have Kim Cattola from Cradle My Heart Radio on our Comrex line. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you. Never,
thank you.
Ever get tired of saying that. I love it. Are you more or less ready to go for the big Christmas?
No, it's just that the 25th arrives and you stop. I don't think it's ever really ready.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's start with a true Christmas miracle. There's a baby that was born from a frozen embryo that was frozen for 24 years. I don't know if I have that information right. The only thing I can relate to is I once had a Swanson's frozen TV dinner in my freezer for 24 years. I never ate it, but...
You're right, though, about the facts of this case, which it's stunning. This baby was conceived as an embryo for embryo donation, not for donation, but for in vitro fertilization, conceived 24 years ago.
Wow.
And so then she was adopted from through the National Embryo Donation Center, which is a faith-based organization in Tennessee. She was adopted, and her mom, Tina Gibson, is 26. So Tina said, we could have been friends in school because the baby who's now a few months old was conceived about a year and a half after Tina. And so it really is stunning. Cryopreservation techniques 24 years ago were not what they are today, but they were basic and they worked. And so this baby, instead of having been destroyed as an embryo, is now blessing this family.
Little Emma. There's an adorable picture of her that I'm looking at right now. And she was 6 pounds, 8 ounces and 20 inches long. So a healthy little baby.
You know, and there have been 700 embryo adoptions through the Snowflake Baby Programs, as they're known. And in, you know, these babies, these embryos would have been destroyed otherwise. And there have been custody cases, high-profile custody cases, where an embryo, one of the partners decides, no, we don't want that baby, so we want those embryos destroyed. But this is a real alternative. And when you see the babies, it's really hard to refute that this was a human life from the very beginning. And so it's very good news, and it's really, it is. It's a very happy miracle.
Kim, looking at a piece of really good news, I see that there's a lot of abortion clinics that have closed in 2017. So we can look back over the year and say that trend continues.
Well, Operation Rescue does this from time to time, Bill, and they go through and they contact abortion businesses and they ask them about their prices and about their procedures and their existence, because the government doesn't survey that. The Center for Disease Control has an abortion surveillance report that they put out. There's always like a 2-year lag. So I think their most recent information comes from 2014, maybe. But anyway, Operation Rescue, yes, has found that there are about 700 abortion facilities and 49 closed in 2017, 35 surgical facilities and 14 medication-only clinics either closed or halted their abortion services. And some of this has to do with states enacting laws that would require them to operate in ways that are safer but also more expensive. And so once the profit margin closes through safety measures, a lot of these, you know, facilities shut down.
There are still 704 abortion facilities, though, that do remain in the U.S., and 490 offer surgical abortions. So our work is not done.
That's right. But, you know, the pregnancy help movement, the pregnancy help community has also put up 4,000 life-affirming pregnancy centers as an answer. And that's just exponential growth and exponential shrinking. Just 2 years ago, those numbers were a lot closer, where you were seeing it almost an equal number of pregnancy centers to abortion providers. And it's changing. Part of it, Bill, is yes, more people are aware that there are alternatives to abortion. Part of it is abortion is being taken into hospitals, because that effort has been funded by big donors like Warren Buffett. Part of it is, you know, medication abortion that women are procuring through online sources in ways that are more difficult to track. So we still have to convince and persuade women and give them the support to help them see that no one ever needs to resort to abortion as any sort of recourse.
So obviously one of the reasons these clinics are closing is due to a decreased demand for abortions. But Kim, is it safe to say that abortive patients are starting to take a center stage with how women are dealing with pregnancies, unwanted pregnancies?
Yeah, I think so. Whether it's, you know, any contraceptive method that destroys the embryo. Once the embryo is there, Bill, there's new life. Medical texts agree on this, over 20 embryology textbooks, that the embryo is a distinct, living, and whole human being. So therefore, any birth control method that destroys the embryo after conception is an abortifacient. It brings about an abortion. This may be IUDs, it may be some of the medications, it may be hormonal birth control in some cases. And we're seeing, by the way, the reports of the adverse health impact of women and a clear, bright line being drawn between some of those birth control methods and increased risks for cancer in the future. So, yeah, abortifacients are something that need our attention. And definitely, you know, we need to not buy into the abortion rights activist point of view that says, well, if you're against abortion, you should just be in favor of birth control. Sometimes they're one and the same.
Mm-hmm. And some of the abortion doctors, they're starting to either retire or die. And is there something in today's medical schools where the students are saying, boy, I want to go become an abortionist?
Well, they're being, like I say, it's being funded. And, you know, if you go to the archives, just Google New York Times abortion training in medical schools. I think that will probably help you find the article that came out probably 3 or 4 years ago now, which buried in the deep in the midst of that article, you learn about Warren Buffett's funding of abortion mainstreaming, putting it in hospitals so nobody has to run a gauntlet of abortion protesters at a standalone facility. This has been the vision, that they will mainstream it into medical practice and do it by training young doctors so that it becomes a normal part of what they offer, you know, in their practices. In that article, many, many, many of the young doctors said, no. Of course, I see what this is, and no, I will not be participating in that, and no. You know, but then if medical school makes it mandatory part of the training, and there's a conscience issue that's unfolding on medical schools because of that. But yeah, that's a very quiet frontier, Bill, where a lot is happening to advance abortion as, you know, as a worldview, that it's needed, that it's necessary, that it's common, that it's normal, that it's good. All of these values around abortion are being heavily, heavily funded by people with very deep pockets.
Well, let's continue this conversation after the break. I'm speaking to Kim Cotola from Cradle My Heart Radio. We'll be back in a minute. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. Who doesn't like Whoville? Anyway, I'm talking to Kim Cotola from Cradle My Heart Radio. Kim, as more and more abortion clinics are getting shut down in 2017, is there more licensing and safety regulations and state laws that are crippling some of these clinics?
Yes, absolutely. It happens on a state-by-state basis, Bill. And, you know, of course, the abortion rights activists will cry that this is the war on women, you know, that you're trying to limit access, which that's been argued at the Supreme Court in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that if you have a constitutional right to abortion, you have to, you know, have access to that abortion. But the states have found ways to limit access. The states have found ways to regulate. The states have found ways to shut down shady providers. Because guess what happens when the state doesn't regulate abortion? Guess what happens? You know, women die in unsafe facilities.
Yeah.
Hundreds of women have died in safe, legal abortion, Bill. So, yeah, I think that is a big thing that we can all celebrate. And by the way, that the article that I referenced came out in 2010. It was in the New York Times, and it was called The New Abortion Providers. But if you want to research Susan Buffett's efforts to fund abortion education in medical schools, I think you'll be very surprised. And I think it'll be an eye-opening look for you into what our work is in prayer. And, you know, if God leads you into activism and into being prepared, I think most of all, Bill, for us, the average person who understands the sanctity of life and that every life is sacred, being prepared to say to a person who's pregnant and thinks that there's no alternative but abortion, here's how I'm going to help you to make a life-affirming choice, mm-hmm. whether it would be referring to the pregnancy help community or, yep, rolling up your sleeves and becoming part of the solution. That's what we're called on to do.
Can we talk about Susan Buffett? Does she have a really rich dad?
Her husband, she's deceased now, but Warren Buffett and she started a foundation. And, you know, in this search, by the way, looking into where their ties are, they're extremely secretive. So Mother Jones reported on this. Philanthropy Women have reported on it. One outlet called him the $1 billion abortion king. Hmm. And that was Media Research Center. And I think that their work is very reliable. But Warren Buffett, yes, the $1 billion king of abortion through the Susan Buffett Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was this immigrant teen that was trying to get an abortion and get U.S. taxpayers to pay for it. Of course, I think the Trump administration has already taken this to the Supreme Court. This is opening up a floodgate of issues regarding immigrant teens wanting to come to America and having U.S. taxpayers pay for their abortions. Where are we, Kim, with this?
Well, according to the ACLU's findings, by the way, Bill, the shelters have housed about 420 pregnant girls from October of last year through September of this year. And 18 of those requested abortion, 5 changed their minds, but 11 had abortions. 2 released from the shelters, placed with sponsors, the outcome not known. That's what the government has been proposing, by the way, that, okay, you need a sponsor to help you carry out your plans now that you're in America. I think that's reasonable. You know, when none could be found for Jane Doe, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. You know, they came in the middle of the night, literally, and took her to get that abortion while the case was still pending, while there were still hearings pending. But the same judge who upheld that has now upheld other abortions being constitutionally protected for immigrant teens who are in detention because they don't have legal immigration status yet. It's an amazing pass that we're at and not likely to be resolved anytime soon other than, you know, the courts with Barack Obama appointed judges is saying, yep, abortion for all. And wow, I mean, I don't think it's an overstatement, Bill, to say, you know, could abortion become a magnet mm-hmm. for people who want to come here? And, you know, particularly in most of South America, abortion is still illegal. So you get to the United States, you land pregnant, and now the government has to facilitate your abortion. I don't think that is what American values stand for, and I don't think that's what American taxpayers ought to be compelled to support.
Mm-hmm. Kim, the pro-life advocates are kind of celebrating the Ohio legislature's passage of a bill to ban abortion of babies diagnosed with Down syndrome.
Yes. And, you know, 2 other states have made state measures along those lines. Indiana was rolled back. That was voted in under Governor Pence, who's now, of course, our vice president. But Ohio has taken this step, and Governor Kasich is expected to be able to prevail with this. He's been extremely pro-life as the governor there, and has signed on to, I think, 20 different pieces of pro-life legislation, including this one. And really, Bill, what we're trying to do with this at the state level is trying to avoid becoming like Iceland, where I think only 4 children with Down syndrome were born last year. The rest were aborted in utero. And Down syndrome is not a life-threatening condition. It's a genetic condition. And, you know, allowing abortion on that basis, those who argue against it are saying, look, that's the ultimate in disability discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kim, now I know you lived in Minnesota for a long time, and it looks like our Senator Al Franken is going to finally resign. I think January 2 is the day.
It's been a changing landscape ever since, since he said he was, and
yes.
He wasn't. And a late entry for word of the year, unresign.
Right.
That came up in a lot of conversations about him. And that's not unprecedented, right? I think Larry Craig unresigned after he resigned after, again, the Minnesota incident at the airport a while ago.
Yeah.
Unpleasant memory.
Yes.
Anyway, yeah, so the latest on this I'm seeing is that Tim Pawlenty may step in mm-hmm. in a special election to try to fill that seat. I think some of the other names that have come out are Karen Housley. She's a state senator, Republican from Washington County, announcing that she's going to try to run for that seat. So Governor Dayton has said that he will appoint the lieutenant governor. And she's, of course, you know, deep into the abortion rights advocacy movement and has worked there and has, you know, followed the ideology of Planned Parenthood as one of their former executives to the letter. So there's a lot at stake in what will happen in that election to fill Senator Franken's seat.
Mm-hmm. Kim, I hope you have a wonderful Christmas. I don't know what your plans are, but I hope you have a lot of joy and happiness and love and laughter and all that stuff that makes Christmas such a great time of the year.
Thank you, Bill. You know, and if you've never pondered it, just think about the unexpected, unplanned pregnancy, if you will, that started the salvation of the world.
Mm.
Every unexpected pregnancy is a blessing.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you so much. I will talk to you soon.
Thank you, Bill. Merry Christmas.
You bet. It's about 4 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and be back.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and
thank you so much to Dr. Michael Heisner. How amazing is that guy? That is a great book. I recommend that completely. And also Kim Cotola from Cradle My Heart Radio. She always has such important, relevant information about the pro-life issues and movement. And we can thank her that she is always looking out on behalf of the unborn. All right, we've got a great second hour coming up. In studio, Dr. Peter Kapsner is here with a very, very special guest. And we're excited about that. So we're looking forward to that. And then Brett Hagler, one of the most innovative guys that I've heard about. And I met him, and Forbes said he was one of the most impressive under 30-year-olds that you'll meet. So we'll have him coming up soon. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.